From complicated financing to utility opposition, local renewable energy projects often face a rocky path to completion. But Co-op Power, an energy cooperative based in Massachusetts, has pioneered new ways to allow ordinary individuals to make investments collectively in the renewable energy economy. Isaac Baker, a founding member of Co-op Power and its current vice president of Community Solar, spoke recently with ILSR's own John Farrell about Co-op Power's success so far, its innovative strategies, and how to grow the community energy movement. This is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy.
So I wanted to start off by talking about how having a cooperative structure for your business, for your solar business, or for any other renewable energy business, can change how you raise money for renewable energy projects. And particularly, does it get around some of the barriers that we mentioned in ILSR's recent report on community renewable energy, such as when regulations about selling securities make it hard to raise money for energy projects?
Yeah, so this has been, securities has been one of the biggest focuses of Co-op Power and thinking about how we can democratize access to renewable energy. And specifically, that's in helping communities figure out how to raise funds and to own assets in their community. The way that we at Co-op Power have been addressing this and have been using the co-op structure to raise funds has been that under the co-op exemption, we can raise up to $1 million on a 12-month rolling basis to support our projects from accredited and non-accredited investors. And as long as we are talking to our membership, we're able to talk about making investments in our company collectively, and we can cast a really wide net using the consumer co-op, which gives us access to a lot of resources to fund future projects.
So just to clarify then, what's the difference? You mentioned you can raise $1 million in 12 months from accredited and non-accredited investors. What's the difference between the two?
Accredited investors is a very small portion of the population. There are a few qualifications for an accredited investor, but folks who make over $200,000 a year or have over $1 million in assets are two of the kinds of qualifications. Sophisticated, generally high net worth individuals qualify as accredited investors and don't need protection or the same level of scrutiny from the Securities and Exchange Commission. Non-accredited investors is basically everyone else. So you could think of that as a kind of like 5% of the population versus the other 95% of the population who might also want to be able to make investments in local community projects.
So that's great that the co-op has a way to tap into both of those kinds of investors on an annual basis. Let's talk about one other thing that clean energy projects want access to, and that's the tax credits, particularly the federal tax credits for renewable energy. Co-op Power has developed a new twist on community solar that includes direct ownership. Does this make it easier to use tax credits?
Absolutely. Thanks to what we've found is in the past year, folks have been trying to figure out how to make the tax credit more accessible to communities. And there was a private letter ruling that came out in October of 2015 that said that we could take the residential tax credit and distribute it from a central array that was owned by multiple consumers to allow folks to benefit from that tax credit in panels that they own off-site or not on their own building, but that are located on one central array with their neighbors. And that is what Co-op Power has been doing. We've been through our direct ownership shared solar model that we're rolling out in Massachusetts and New York right now. Residents are able to buy into a project by actually owning panels in one of these larger ground-mounted or roof-mounted arrays that we've seen popping up around the state, and that they can actually benefit from that tax credit directly against their income taxes, making the investment much more attractive and valuable for an individual consumer.
Does that also help too? You know, one of the challenges that we find with traditional solar projects is that you need, in order to get that tax credit, you typically have some sort of tax equity investor. In other words, somebody who's got a lot of tax liability, who's willing to absorb the tax credit when you can't do that with the members themselves in exchange for a pretty healthy return, you know, and providing some of the upfront capital for the project. Does being able to distribute the tax credits here then lower the cost of doing solar because you don't need that kind of partner?
That's exactly right. Those kinds of partners are what we call tax equity investors who are willing to basically invest with their relatively large tax bill to monetize tax credits on behalf of a community. They take a pretty significant return or cut of the profit on the project. And so if we're able to more directly get the value back to consumers, we're able to keep more of that margin back and put more of that back in consumers' pockets. So at the end of the day, those tax equity investors can enable some business models to work effectively, but ultimately where we're able to distribute that value directly back to the consumer, we keep more of those dollars locally and in the project.
It seems like not needing tax equity is one of the big distinctions between Co-op Power's direct ownership model and your sort of traditional shared solar subscriber model. Are there other significant differences between the two?
One of the main things, too, that we see, particularly in Massachusetts, where we've had a relatively high state-level incentive program, is that when we have a third-party finance model, the third-party investor invests and uses the tax credits from the solar project, and they also receive all of the state subsidies and incentives, which in our state have been very, very high here in Massachusetts. So that's represented a very significant value stream of tax credits and state incentives going back to the investors, and a relatively small portion of the actual electricity value just getting returned to the end consumer. And so that was our big impetus for developing this direct ownership shared solar model, was to take that tax credit, those state incentives, which could be worth up to 28 cents a kilowatt hour right now, and then also the electricity value produced by those panels, and to distribute all of that back to the consumer. So that's the biggest difference between this and what we've seen so far.
And I guess one other thing that's important to note is that the cooperative structure itself is a difference in a lot of these. You know, I'm in Minnesota. We have a community solar statute and are hopefully going to see some projects actually put some steel on the ground or on a roof and generate some energy soon. But most of these projects are going to be owned by a third party and not by the folks who are subscribing to the solar arrays. And so that means that if there are, for example, profits in the development of the project, maybe the project cost comes in lower than expected, the revenues from the subscriptions is higher than expected, the benefits go to that third party, but that's going to be different with a cooperative structure like Co-op Power, am I right?
That's exactly right. So we do transparent development, and we also do participatory planning for our projects. So we've seen a lot of communities not only wanting to buy into solar arrays, but wanting to have a better degree of say in where we develop solar, right? Are we paving over farmland, or are we putting it on parking lots? And letting consumers be a part of the development process for renewable energy projects, and then allowing them to buy and own and have a democratic say in how that business entity that owns and manages the array runs for the next 25 years is our goal there. So we see that there's a lot of value there, where we also have, as you saw with some of the larger entities like SunEdison and other larger developers, where they would go and build up a lot of these farms, and then we've had a lot of these larger solar companies go out of business. So we also see that Co-op Power as a cooperative has a lot of staying power, where folks can more reliably feel that they're going to have a manager that they can count on who's going to maintain and operate the array over its life.
If I recall, we've had some conversations before about Co-op Power's model, but I think at one point you talked about sort of a barn-raising model that members can do sweat equity in order to help lower the cost of projects, something that you don't often see when a third-party development model.
That's exactly right. So unfortunately, what we have in Massachusetts, where we've been doing a lot of work, is that we can't actually bring folks onto the job site during construction, which was the most tangible form of what you'd think of as sweat equity in a solar project, because our unions have required there to be a lot of master electricians and folks on the job site, and they don't want a lot of untrained labor on the job site. So what we do is that through that participatory planning and development, the soft costs of solar, which folks talk about a lot, can actually add up. So we use our community planning and development process to actually bring down those soft costs. Where, for instance, recruiting folks to come and buy some panels in the solar array, we don't have to do that because our members go and recruit their neighbors. So that lowers our costs as staff that we would have to spend going and recruiting the other participants in the array. In many cases, going to find the site, we don't have to do a lot of work for, because our members will go out and find them. So a lot of that kind of upfront legwork, and then moving projects through permitting, can also be incredibly expensive for renewable energy projects. And our members sit on town planning committees and are integrated into the community, really, into all of the governing bodies. And so we have a lot of insight into how to move effectively through those processes as well that you wouldn't see again with a standard for-profit developer.
So I appreciate a lot of the context here about the cooperative in general and how it's able to both give access and potentially lower costs to folks, also to give people a real say in how the process works. Let's talk a little bit about low-income folks. There's been a lot more discussion in the past year or two about how we make solar available to everybody and not just folks who have means already. Could you tell me some more about Co-op Power's reverse community solar model and how that helps to reach low-income participants?
So what we found over the past 2 years of doing research is that more or less for folks, we have a loan program that helps people who want to buy panels in that direct ownership model. And that's really for folks who are at median income, you know, or maybe about 80% of median income and above. That can be a really attractive offer to take out a loan and actually to own some solar panels in an offsite array and to use that tax credit. And for folks who fall below 80% of median income, that's not going to be as attractive. And so for those folks, we wanted to create a no money down option where we still had another party take use of the tax credit, but directed as much of the savings back to those low income folks as possible. So that was the background that gave us this program that looks a lot like a reverse community solar program, and has been called the Solar Access Program. And we spun off a separate company called Resonant Energy that's working in partnership with Co-op Power to develop these projects across New York and Massachusetts. So the concept of the Solar Access Program is that it's very similar to a rooftop lease insofar as we go into community and lease individual rooftops. And the deal for the homeowner is that they get 20% of the output applied to their bill as a credit, and they sign no long-term contract. So all they need to do is make their roof available, and the other 80% of the power, we virtually net meter or send to what we call an anchor institution's bill. And so what that allows us to do is we can build a whole portfolio of 100 households in a community, and they've all agreed to lease their roof and take 20% of the output as part of their compensation for that. And then the remaining percent, we aggregate together in a pool and put on an anchor institution's bill. And what this means is that that anchor institution, they still pay on a power purchase basis for that 80% of the power. So the income back to the investor comes from one creditworthy institution. And so in that way, that anchor institution is acting to perform a credit enhancement function and enable all of those roofs in the community to go solar where they wouldn't otherwise be able to do it because of low credit scores or underwriting challenges.
One of the questions I have here, when you talk about aggregating projects, so now you're saying, you know, that it's not just one or two of these rooftop solar projects, but it could be 50 or 100 that this anchor institution is subscribing to get the energy from, and that many people that are able to participate.
That's exactly right. So this is very much this is a rooftop model, and it works best in urban areas where the value of electricity is relatively high. So the places where this is well suited are the places where that standard community solar model really doesn't work, where we see in Boston and New York and a lot of the urban areas we've looked at, there aren't any large ground-mounted areas where you could build one central array, but there's a lot of open rooftop space. And so this model is really geared towards solving for both the low-income access and the urban setting where we have high value of electricity. And so, but as you, to your point, John, what this allows us to do is to, and we're already going around to municipalities, colleges and universities, and other large electricity users in the community that want to support low-income solar development and asking them to sign a long-term power purchase agreement to buy solar off of these rooftops. And that allows us to go around to churches, to nonprofits, to low-income households, and really to any rooftop in our urban environment, and to give them this great deal where they can go solar for no money down and just get savings.
What's an example of the kind of anchor institution that you'd have that would help support this model by being the subscriber to all of these projects?
It's really going to be any large electricity user in an urban area. So what we've seen is that, for instance, we've been working with a lot of MIT students in their graduate program. And MIT, with its research facilities and all that, uses a great deal of electricity and is actively interested in considering purchasing power in this way. So both colleges and universities and municipalities who could purchase it and apply these credits could be a hospital or any school district or any place that's using a lot of electricity right now. And we're also actively talking with neighborhood development corporations and CDCs and a lot of other folks who own these portfolios of buildings that are all using electricity. And we could be using that buying power to enable solar to happen all in the community around them.
Cool. I want to ask you something about kind of the way that the market's changing since Massachusetts is one of your big places of operation. I know that there are proposals to replace the solar renewable energy credit system with a feed-in tariff model. So projects will get a fixed price, a 10 to 15 year contract for the power that they produce. And I noticed that it even has kind of a price bonus for our community solar. Is that switch to the feed-in tariff going to make development easier for co-op power? Will it be harder to do community solar?
So in general, as with all things, what we have now is just a straw proposal as of October in 2016. So we don't know exactly how the whole program is going to be implemented. But insofar as what's been communicated to this point, we've been generally supportive of it. What we've seen is that they've got more price signals for the kinds of development they want to see. So they're encouraging with actual adders in the policy where you get a few extra cents per kilowatt hour if you develop projects that go on rooftops, that go on carports, that go on landfills, and then also projects that support community solar and low-income access. That's all policy that we're really excited about. And the only question for our model really breaks down to how this feed-in tariff works. What's been so successful for us in developing these innovative business models is that through virtual net metering as a policy, and then our SREC program that we had previously, we had two entirely fungible things that we could send around to different bills and to different parties. And that allowed us to do this matchmaking. And so the big question in the implementation of this new program for us is just once they establish how much the feed-in tariff is, the question is who gets it, what bills is it sent to, and how easy is it to share around across multiple bills or to multiple end users is going to be our big concern going forward.
So I always like to end with a nice open-ended question for you, and maybe this feed-in tariff thing will be your answer, but you know, what's the biggest barrier that if we had a magic wand that we could remove to let everyone in Massachusetts go solar with co-op power?
I would say certainly at the state level, supporting those incentives that support things like community ownership, low-income access are a key policy pieces for us. But ultimately, our biggest challenge and the challenge for the state has been more on the electrical side, really figuring out with utilities how communities can come together and can put in an application to build a shared solar project and can have a collaborative process in working with the utility that does not cost communities as much as it has right now. So the problem is that in solar development, there's a lot of pay-to-play that goes on, and it can cost $50,000 to, you know, $500,000 to get a project permitted before you even know whether or not you can move forward. And right now, what we call that the pre-development cost has been a big enough barrier that we've seen a lot of projects not go forward or not even be able to get started because of that large at-risk capital requirement. So if we could see one thing that would facilitate more cooperatively owned shared solar development in the state, it would be having access to more pre-development capital or having state and technical resources that are supporting communities in figuring out how to plug into the grid and get these projects online.
When you talk about the issue of this pre-development cost, and I think you mentioned the word permitting, are we talking about a cost associated with getting a grid connection or an agreement with the utility? Or are we talking about permitting on the municipal side where it's the state or local rules that are making it challenging for projects to start moving forward?
Both can be challenging, and certainly both can be costly. I would say the main point that of contention has been with getting the interconnection application through with the utility. Often for these larger projects, they require you to pay for a third-party interconnection impact study, where a third party does a many month long study starting at $10,000 going up to $30,000 to study what the impact on the grid will be if you plug in your array where you're proposing. Both that cost and that amount of time makes it relatively difficult to build these projects. And they can come back at the end of that study and tell you that for X, Y, and Z reason, it's simply going to be impossible for you to interconnect your project at any kind of reasonable cost to the grid where you've proposed. But they have no transparency about how to understand the circuits and the grids prior to that study happening. So to a lot of degree, this development is happening in the dark, where communities and developers are going around and having conversations and trying to understand what the grid is looking like, whereas if the utility were more transparent about saying, this is where smart solar development can and should happen on our grid, and actually turn that over to the public, we would have a lot more ability to avoid a lot of costs and time in developing these projects.
I've heard that in California, for example, that utilities are required to publish kind of interactive maps of their distribution system with at least some kind of that information. Is that the kind of information you'd be looking for that would help solve this problem?
That is exactly the kind of thing that would help solve this problem. And we have been in pitched legislative battles all across the Northeast to try and get more support for initiatives like that, where that allows for smart planning. And what we're looking into, where Massachusetts right now is about to launch this next policy initiative with the feed-in tariff to support another 1,600 megawatts of development going in the next 5 years. And all the larger solar developers are realizing that our circuits and our feeders are full, and that in order to add more solar to any of these distribution lines, we're going to have to start rebuilding substations every time we want to build a project. And so what that means is that only the very largest projects are going to move forward, and we're really going to have to start confronting how we want to deal with grid modernization, where we replace substations and replace infrastructure to allow for distributed generation in a way that doesn't put that entire price tag on the backs of new solar projects.
That's fascinating. You kind of mentioned that a lot of the traditional community solar projects, you know, have taken advantage of, you know, open land in suburban or rural areas. Do you feel like, you know, when you talk about the circuits being full for these larger solar developers, are you talking about in that kind of instance in terms of the rural areas and the places where you build the big solar arrays versus the urban environment, or are you saturated from top to bottom?
It's different problems, but it's mostly those rural feeders where solar developers in our last policy regime were able to build those 5 and 10 megawatt arrays on these relatively rural 13.8 kV lines. And those lines have now been pretty well filled. And through this next policy, we're going to have to start doing more significant upgrades. In urban areas, what we find is that because our urban circuits are older and have a lot more historical challenges to them, we have challenges that arise there where we have area networks in cities that are from the earliest iterations of the grid that don't allow you to backfeed solar very easily when you want to add to the grid. So really those city areas are not effective for solar development. And so that's a challenge that we see in the urban environment as well. So we can continue to build these smaller rooftop projects in cities, and there's still a lot of space on the circuits. But that being said, it's harder to make rooftops move forward for a lot of reasons.
Well, I could talk to you all day about this kind of thing, because I love getting in the weeds about the grid's capacity to expand distributed generation. But I wanted to just give you an opportunity to tell people a little bit about the success of co-op power. Like, what have you been able to accomplish in terms of renewable energy development with your cooperative model?
Yeah, so for co-op power, what we're really excited about is what we've been able to accomplish as far as renewable energy goes, is that we've spent the last 10 years using a lot of those community-based fundraising strategies to fundraise for a $4.3 million biodiesel plant that's going to be coming online in the next couple of months here in early 2017. So we're really excited to be at the end of the line of a very, very long fundraising and development process around that to bring some manufacturing jobs back to a rural area in western Massachusetts. So that's one of our biggest accomplishments. And as for solar, it's taken us about the last 3 years to really put together all of this infrastructure around financing and development and expertise. So a lot of what we're seeing in solar is what we're going to do going forward. We've supported hundreds of rooftop solar and hot water installations for our consumers over the last 10 years. And getting into larger community scale renewable energy development, we have a few projects that we've done with food co-ops and with other partners and with churches. We're going to be ribbon cutting on bringing three churches together through an interfaith community solar project here in Boston and helping them all go solar with no money down and solving a lot of those barriers there. So we're really excited about what's to come with solar, and that's going to be our big launch next to our other community scale renewable energy projects over the next couple of years.
That was Isaac Baker, Vice President of Community Solar at Co-op Power, telling John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Energy Democracy, about how his cooperative unlocked new opportunities for renewable energy generation. Learn more about Isaac's organization at coppower.coop. Visit ilsr.org to learn more about distributed generation, including community solar, and to find more Local Energy Rules podcasts. Until next time, keep your energy local, and thanks for listening.